This is our number 10.
It's time for the fastest 15 minutes of the news. This is Dory's Fastest 15.
It's a world of news in a tidy little 15-minute package just for you. Welcome to the Fastest 15. It's been a pretty momentous news day nationally that has great local implications with no more mandatory union dues for government union workers. That could be, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how many people opt out and also what kind of pressure is going to be put on them. Because I know that the public unions, they have been in an all-out campaign to just kind of, kind of polish their image, and they want to make sure that their members think very highly of them. So it'll be interesting to see how many people choose to opt out of union dues now that they are no longer required with today's Supreme Court decision. And we got a lot of local news going on, too. Did you see what happened to our buddy Gary Horker over at Cairo TV?
What happened?
So, Nicole, I know you pulled this out. So he's doing a live shot down in Pioneer Square, right?
Well, yeah, he was doing a live shot, but no, he went to the tape when he chose this attack.
This was outside of the live shot. It was right. They were recording at the time.
Exactly. And he was talking to a man that I believe lives at the Union Gospel Mission, and he was asking him if he believed that firefighters should have backup when they come into these calls. He was talking about this, like, tripling their response. Yeah. And the guy in the middle of the interview, he's looking at the cameraman, and a homeless woman came up behind the cameraman with a piece of wire like she was going to strangle him.
She's going to strangle the Cairo 7 cameraman.
Oh. And then the person that Gary was interviewing stepped in, pushed her out of the way, started pushing her off of the cameraman and yelling at her, "This is why they think this about us."
So here's the audio of it. So it's Gary Horker. He's talking to Trevor, who lives at the Union Gospel Mission, when this attack goes down.
I think everybody should feel unsafe in this area.
While we were doing this interview.
Back off. Back off there. People like you make us look bad.
Suddenly, the man we were interviewing stopped a woman who tried to attack our photographer from behind with a homemade weapon, and then she went after him.
So you think it's a good policy for firefighters to come in big groups?
Why not? If we're going to be in groups, they should be.
There's all sorts of crazy behavior out here. You never know what drugs somebody might be on. You might not be able to rationalize with somebody out here. So yeah, they have every right to protect themselves.
You know what's interesting is when I was a kid, Pioneer Square was known as Skid Row of Seattle. It really was. It was a dump. It was filled with bums and vagrants, and then this gigantic gentrification, and we're going to put these, we're going to rebuild all these buildings, put in offices, and we're going to clean it up.
I remember.
It became a wonderful gentrified neighborhood, and now it has devolved about 45 years to what it was, I mean, way worse than what it was when I was a kid, and it was known as Skid Row.
And I think a lot of it is because some of the service providers are located in that area, too.
Yeah. Right. And what we're hearing,
which is unfortunate, but the guy who tried to stop the attack, he's exactly right, and it kind of hurts me every time we say homeless.
Yeah,
I mean, this is not the homeless that we're homeless should evoke sympathy.
That's why I've been working so hard to control our language on this, because we tend to group everybody as homeless, and the truth is, if this guy that they were talking to, he lives at the Union Gospel Mission. Well, I've done some work with the Union Gospel Mission, and what they require is that you be sober. We'll give you a bed. We will help you with job training, and of course, they have a spiritual component in it, all of it as well. But they do it the right way at the Union Gospel Mission. So here's a guy that they're talking with, who, if he's at the Union Gospel Mission, he's trying to get clean, he's trying to get right, and he's trying to, he'll get some job training opportunities. And then you have a woman with a wire trying to strangle the Cairo 7 camera person. And you can't group them all together. There's a difference between the woman who, with her two kids, is getting out of a domestic violence situation, and the heroin addict who has no interest in getting clean. And to just call both of them homeless, it's not serving any of us well. There are vagrants and there are bums and there are innocent homeless. And the spectrum that this covers is pretty broad. So I absolutely agree with you. So the story we told you about yesterday, the fire department, when they send out paramedics, they used to send out crews of two. Now they have to send out crews of four or six. We're also hearing from some cops who are saying, yeah, when we respond around Pioneer Square, that area, we got to go with much greater teams because it's gotten so violent. Here is the assistant fire chief, Brian Hastings, talking to Cairo 7.
One of the biggest concerns we have is that it's a crowd control issue when we get there. But oftentimes, there can be 30, 40 people on the sidewalk. It's very hard for two members, when they come into that scene, to be able to differentiate between what might be a comfortable situation or a situation that might need some assistance with either additional resources or police assistance.
And another one of the persons living on the streets in Pioneer Square says, yeah, it's pretty smart that they have backups now.
Should a firefighter be concerned about his personal safety when he's on the job?
Well, I think he would be probably sadly mistaken if he wasn't. They're obviously wise being in groups.
And Fire Chief Harold Scroggins says they never know what they're going to come upon.
There are many challenges when our firefighters face the RV fires. A lot of unknowns. It depends on what the RV is being used for, how it's been modified, the number of people inside.
Yeah, we have a pretty good idea what they're being used for.
I feel so sorry. You know, we talked about what Pioneer Square used to be. When I first moved here, so in the late 80s, that's where we would go dancing on Friday and Saturday night. You could kind of go from spot to spot, and I mean, there are great restaurants and
One of the reasons they cited the Kingdom where they did, which was a decision that was made in the, I think, right around 70, 71. They built the Kingdom in, I think, 76. But 75 or 76. But one of the reasons they cited it there was they wanted an economic engine to rejuvenate what had become where all the bums and derelicts hung out in Seattle. So they build the Kingdom, and now the Mariners are going to deliver 81 dates a year, and the Sonics ended up playing there and starting in 80, I believe, and the Seahawks. And so you had all those bars and restaurants, and Pioneer Square became a cleaned-up, vital place, and now it's worse than ever. It's really sad. Next up in the Fastest 15, I got some horrible local school stories. You hear about this former school superintendent in our state? His name's, where does his name go? Paul Rozier. He was a Kennewick school superintendent. He's now 76 years old. And Paul Rozier has pleaded guilty to arranging to meet two underage teen girls at a Richmond motel to have sex. This guy was arrested a year ago. He's now pleaded guilty. He exchanged text messages with a 16-year-old girl, or what he thought was a 16-year-old girl. It was really an undercover detective. He was told that the teen, the 16-year-old, had a 13-year-old friend who could meet him in the Tri-Cities. And so this is a school superintendent in our state, former. So he planned to pay the 13-year-old for sex and the 16-year-old for setting it up. And then he showed up at the motel. And, of course, it was one of those. What's the NBC?
Like the Predator. Gotcha.
Predator.
Chris Hansen.
Chris Hansen.
What are you doing here?
I miss that show.
Get enough of the looks on the guys' faces when they know that they've been caught.
And when they try to come up with their lame-o excuses.
Yeah. I knew. I was just going to rescue the girl. I was just going to tell her, don't
she do sounded
this.
Troubled.
But can you imagine? This guy was the executive director of the Washington Association of School Administrators until 2014. And if he's that much of a perv, what was going through his head as he was strolling the halls of the schools where he was an administrator for decades in our state? And then up in Darrington, where we have a lot of great listeners, I know, A school board member in Darrington has had to resign after making a derogatory statement about Native Americans on social media. Nobody is learning from Roseanne.
Seriously.
According to the Daily Herald up there, this former member of the Darrington School Board, now former, he wrote, and I quote, "On the Indian casino, how about calling it Drunk Indians and Government Handouts Casino?" What would make a school board member think that he could survive after posting something like that?
Well, clearly he wasn't thinking, but and he realized very quickly that he wouldn't survive, and he resigned June 15th.
Yeah, but I wonder.
That's got to be. It has to be drunk tweeting.
Drunk tweeting about drunken Indians. And that's the pot calling the kettle black there.
It's so many of these tweets or whatever, postings on social media when they put it up there. It's like without any thought. It's just impulsive and dumb.
And he sent it because a tribe up there, the Sioux Seattle tribe, they announced plans to open a casino near Darrington. So the school board member wrote, "How about calling it Drunk Indians and Government Handouts Casino?"
And who was he thinking was going to laugh at that?
Right. And then he immediately sent a follow-up message that said, "I made a mistake in sending this out." But the damage had been done, and he has now resigned. Up next in the Fastest 15, you guys all like movies. You ever seen any Ron Jeremy movies?
Oh, nice try. Nice setup there, Dory. No, have you?
All filmophiles, or what are they called? What's a...
Porns?
No.
Porn movies?
No.
Sean, what are they called?
If you like the movies, you're a...
Oh, no, don't even...
No, I don't
video
even know.
File.
Videophile, yeah.
Yeah, but nobody has videos anymore. Anyway, I wasn't aware of this. Ron Jeremy, the famous porn star, I don't believe I've ever seen any of his movies.
Oh, you'd know.
Definitely.
What is that supposed to mean? You know, Sean's definitely I'm okay with. The you would know from you, Ursula. What does that mean?
Just from what I've read, you would know.
So
he's famous for a reason. Come on, Tori. Just one quick Google would tell you.
I don't believe in that. So Ron Jeremy is being investigated for a sexual assault on a woman here in Washington State. It happened down in Pierce County, and it happened last year, allegedly. The Tacoma Attorney's Office declined to file, but apparently a radio station was down there. It was a radio station that has rock girls. And so one of them asked Ron Jeremy to sign her breast, and she alleges that not only did he autograph her breast, but then he did some groping and pulled down her shirt and reached under her bra, and she said violently groped her breast and then touched her in other ways. And so now they are going to pursue. The Tacoma City Attorney's Office declined to file, but the woman is now suing Ron Jeremy for sexual assault and battery, and it all happened down in Tacoma. I didn't even know he was in the area.
Who knew?
Last
he toured.
Year. Yeah.
He's always in some area, Dory.
Thanks, Sean. Next up in the Fastest 15. Joe Jackson has died. The patriarch of the Jackson family. I know this is a different Joe Jackson. Every time I do this, the singer and the dad are different people.
Why do you do this?
I don't know.
He loves to play Joe Jackson.
Because there's not enough Jackson 5 music.
Every time there was a Joe Jackson story, I would always play this Joe Jackson. I don't know why. It's a bit. It's my deal.
When you have to explain it that much?
But now that Joe Jackson has died at age 89, today might be the last time I'll ever have the opportunity to do this. So Joe Jackson, he sent out a message yesterday that his sunset was near, and then we found out this morning that the patriarch of the Jackson 5 and Jackson family has passed away. And apparently not a very good man. I mean, it sounded like he was a really abusive dad. And I bet he wished that he could have just stayed 19 forever. Be a drag, be like you. Okay, that's enough of Joe Jackson. Hey, you know that I'm just a straight down the middle journalist. And I don't like interjecting my opinion on any of the things we talk about because that goes against my grain. Every once in a while, though, I see a story that I feel almost demands some sort of commentary beyond just the facts of the story. And we like to call this, when I step out of my comfort zone, news and comment.
Now it's time for news and comment, where we go beyond the headlines and bring you perspective and analysis of today's biggest news stories. First, the news.
A woman in Montana, armed with a machete, has been accused of breaking into her ex-boyfriend's home, ordering him to undress, and forcing him to have sex with her. And then 19-year-old Samantha Mears, charged with aggravated burglary and assault with a weapon, she also allegedly then urinated on the ex-boyfriend's bed.
And now, the comment.
To think when I was 19, I couldn't even find anyone to date me.
This has been News and Comment. The views expressed in News and Comment are those of Dory Monson and do not necessarily reflect the views of Cairo Radio.
We got to work on the News and Comment liner elements. It's never very smooth. I got to figure out a better way to do that. We'll work on that. Next time we'll do News and Comment, it'll be much smoother than that. And that there is your fastest 15.
This has been the fastest 15 minutes in the news. Fast Dory's fastest 15.
Give us 15 minutes. We'll give you the world. Down in Pierce County, they just solved a more than 30-year-old murder cold case involving a 13-year-old victim. And how they did it is absolutely fascinating to me. And so the Pierce County prosecutor is going to join us and share all of the details with you. Coming up next, right after Isla checks the news here on the Dory Monson Show. Listening to my show yesterday, I was talking about all of the high-profile murder cases in the greater Seattle area in the last several months where they have no suspects. And one of the ones I mentioned was the murder of two teenage girls down in Burien. But one of the caveats that I offered was just because you don't catch somebody in the first day or week or month or year and even decade, that doesn't mean it's going to go unsolved. Down in Pierce County, you no doubt heard about the guy that they found in Illinois who was the prime suspect in the slaying back in 1986 of a 13-year-old girl. The Pierce County prosecutor is Mark Lindquist. He joins us here on Cairo Radio. Mark, always good to talk to you.
Thanks, Dory. Always happy to talk on your show.
This cold case is that of Jennifer Bastian. She was 13 years old back in 1986, and tell me how young Jennifer was killed.
Well, Jennifer Bastian was one of actually two murder cases we had that summer involving young girls. One of them was Jennifer Bastian, the other was Michelle Welch.
Okay.
Jennifer Bastian was killed that summer, and Michelle Welch was killed about 3 months prior to that in the spring.
Okay.
And both of them went unsolved for decades. And they were believed to be the same suspect because similar ages, similar MOs, and similar time frame, similar location. But we learned through DNA in 2013, just 5 years ago, that in fact it was two separate suspects. So over time, two things happened that made it possible to solve those cases. Number one, DNA technology had advanced to the point where we could develop a profile and a match from an even smaller sample. And number two, DNA is now everywhere, including in, you know, ancestry-type databases.
Yeah, okay. So, and in the case of Jennifer, I know she was just riding her bicycle in Point Defiance Park when she disappeared on an August evening, right?
Right, yes. And the DNA sample at that time was too small to pull a profile from.
The technology
was not sufficiently advanced to pull a profile.
What kind of database do you guys have access to? Does every prisoner, does everybody who comes into the justice system, do they have to provide a DNA sample, or do you have to get a warrant to get that? What is the database and the accessibility of that among people who are known criminals?
In some states, when somebody is arrested, they pull a DNA sample. In Washington, only upon conviction do we pull a DNA sample.
Okay, but you don't need a warrant for that. It's just automatic. Upon conviction, you can take a sample.
That's correct, and it goes into a system called CODIS that is a national database.
Okay, and is the state to the interstate access to this database outstanding?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So walk me through this. So you've ended up with a 60-year-old guy, Robert Washburn, who is the prime suspect in this murder of Jennifer Bastian. So just walk me through how you arrived at that conclusion.
So back in 2013, the DNA technology advanced to a point where we could pull a profile from a very small sample that was left at the crime scene in 1986. Once investigators had that profile, they put it into that database we were just talking about, CODIS. But there was no match because Mr. Washburn had never been convicted of anything. So he was not in the system. So we had a profile, but we had no match for that profile. Then what happened was the detectives started scouring through other DNA databases, including these private databases that are out there in the Ancestry.com type websites. You're familiar with those?
Yeah.
And so there was a hit, not on a direct individual, but on a family type of DNA. And so from there, they started honing down who that could be within that family. And they found Mr. Washburn, who had been in the area at the time.
That's amazing. Okay, now, when you first entered from that small sample and found no hits, is there a way within the system that if Washburn, let's say that you didn't have the ancestry DNA thing, if Washburn had committed a robbery 10 or 15 years ago and they took a DNA sample then, would there be some automatic alert that, hey, the guy you were looking for who murdered that 13-year-old girl in 1986, he's in the system now? Is there anything like that in that system?
Yes. If he had been convicted of a robbery or some other felony, his DNA would have been in the system and there would have been a hit. There would have been a match.
But you also said that it was a very small sample and now you guys are far more advanced, or the people who do that sort of thing for you, they're far more advanced in being able to extract from smaller and smaller samples?
That's correct. Back in 1986, it was called DQ Alpha technology. It's now called STR technology. But in practical terms, what this means is we can now develop a profile match from an infinitesimal sample. You know, Dory, when I was a prosecutor about 15 years ago, first starting to do DNA cases, I would say to juries, hey, it's not like the movies and TV. You can't just pull DNA from somebody touching something. But guess what? We're now at a point where it is almost like movies and TV. From these infinitesimal samples, we can pull a useful profile.
And yet OJ is walking around a free man today. I'm trying to figure that part out. Okay. And that's how bad the DNA sampling was there back then.
I hadn't thought about that.
Jeez.
And a good point.
Yeah. Why can't? Would that be double jeopardy?
It would be double jeopardy.
So they can't take advanced technology and retry OJ now.
Now that is a good example of a case that today with our technology we would have had.
Got it. Okay. Hey, I asked a question on my show, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, because as I said when I was introducing you, we've had a lot of murders that have gone unsolved the last several months here in the greater Seattle area. And I know that you're the Pierce County prosecutor, so you can't speak to what happens in King County. But I asked the question. I wonder if the solve rate is higher or lower than it was 10 or 20 years ago. Because it seems with technology it should be higher that we were just talking about. But do you have any numbers for me down there in Pierce County?
Yeah, agreed. It should be higher, and it is higher in Pierce County. I'll tell you this, nationally, the solve rate for homicides, and this might surprise you, the solve rate is only 63% nationally.
What?
In Pierce, yeah, I know.
Seriously, 37% of murders in this country go unsolved?
That's correct. In Pierce County, the solve rate is about 80%. And the most difficult homicides to solve, generally speaking, Dory, are gang homicides, where you have uncooperative witnesses, and stranger homicides, like the Bastion case, where there's no connection, no known connection between the victim and the defendant. In Pierce County, you know, we've always had a good solve rate, but it's been getting better. And the reasons can twofold. One, gang violence is down in Pierce County, so that helps our solve rate go up. And secondly, advances in DNA technology we are on top of, and we're using those to solve the stranger homicides.
Well, yeah, and like I said, I know you can't speak to a King County case, but we had two teenage girls, 13 and 17, gunned down in a Burien apartment complex. There were dozens, maybe 50 people who saw it. It was undoubtedly gang-related. And it's unbelievable to me, Mark, that nobody will talk. When you got two teenage girls dead and nobody will talk in cases like that.
Yeah, that is unbelievable and disturbing.
But you run into it all the time, right?
Yes. As I said, those gang homicides, among the most difficult to solve for that reason. You know, technology is wonderful, but you still need to do old-fashioned police work and get witness statements.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, good work. And where are you in the process with Robert Washburn now?
Mr. Washburn has been arraigned. He's being held on $5 million bail. And that case, generally speaking, those type of cases will take about a year or more to get to trial.
And even with the DNA, I assume he is saying he did not do it?
He did plead not guilty at arraignment.
Yeah,
yes.
Got it. Okay. Pierce County Prosecutor Mark Lindquist. That was fascinating. I always enjoy talking with you, Mark.
Thank you, Dory.
And I'd love to hear your thoughts on all of this. You can text me at 98973. And we have much more still to come here in the Dory Monson Show. That's what we hear all the time from the left. Oh, yeah, and we will bomb you. That's the latest threat that's come out. A left-wing writer who's got an awful lot of Twitter followers, and I'm not going to say his name, and I'm not going to say who he works for, but he works for a very prominent website. But I choose to not give them any additional publicity. He just wrote, when you aggressively bleep with people's lives, you should not be surprised when they decide to bleep with yours. And he is now warning the Trump administration that opponents on the left are prepared to carry out 1970s style domestic bomb attacks all around the country. And what he's talking about is, you know, like the Weather Underground. Back in the early 70s, there were left-wing radicals then that killed a lot of people, and they carried out all kinds of bombings. These are people that were later close confidants and friends of President Obama. But back in the 70s, the radical left, they were carrying out bomb attacks. And that is the latest prediction now, that things have gotten so ugly and acrimonious in this country that the welcoming, tolerant, inclusive end of the spectrum is prepared to start launching some bombings around the country. So, but this is how fast things have degraded. And we've been talking about this a lot lately. I have to tell you, I'm a little shocked that intern at the U.S. Capitol who screamed F Trump and was caught on tape screaming that, she didn't get fired, which is just unbelievable to me. She's working for Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire, and they announced that the 19-year-old intern got a one-week suspension for screaming F Trump in the United States Capitol building. And I don't care what your political leanings are, but when you have that kind of degradation of civility in the Capitol and within the government, and I know there are people who say, what does the president do all the time? I don't believe that anybody should tolerate that from a 19-year-old intern. And I guarantee you that I wouldn't if somebody on my staff, you know, just because they disagree with somebody who doesn't like my show, would scream or write or tweet, F someone. And the president's spokesperson, Kellyanne Conway, she was talking this morning, and she talked about that intern that yelled that in the Capitol.
Look what this intern last week, a congressional summer intern, her name is Caitlin Marriott. I'm sure she's being deified on the left, the socialist left.
She got a week suspension.
She got a week suspension and still has her job. I guarantee you, I talked to the president this morning. He says hello, by the way. I can promise you on his behalf that if a White House intern here this summer ever said anything like that to an elected official, let alone the president of the United States, the F word followed by the name, harassing elected officials like Leader McConnell and his wife, cabinet secretary last night, I guarantee you that person would be gone.
Yeah, a mob of woke guys. Mitch McConnell's wife is a member of the cabinet, and she had to fight them off yesterday. And I'm telling you, if a bunch of young men accosted a female member of a Democratic candidate, they would be blasted as being, you know, just these, you know, male pigs who are accosting a woman. But they've become heroes because they accost a member of the cabinet. And Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she has to get Secret Service protection now. She got kicked out of that Red Hen restaurant over the weekend. But you know, not just that, but of course, Peter Fonda, when he went on his tweet storm last week where he suggested that Barron Trump be raped by a pedophile, he also suggested that Sarah Huckabee Sanders' two kids should be kidnapped and spirited away from her. And then you got this blogger who says that the radical left should start bombing America the way the Weather Underground did back in the early 70s. Yeah, it's gotten very nasty indeed. Okay, we're going to check the top of the hour news for you, and then the big lead at 2 is coming up next.